Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who, during the course of living her own life, is able to bring us an expanded and very often hopeful view of tomorrow. Today, you come to us, Lisa Luckett, as a post 9/11 widow. So I thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your story.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's my honor to be with you today.
Now, Lisa, I would like to start with what Lisa's life was like before 9/11. Briefly give us a sense of where you were born, your family, and perhaps some of your childhood dreams.
Okay, so I was born in New Jersey. I'm a Jersey girl, and I live at the coast where Bruce Springsteen hangs out, and it's been a really fun place to grow up. My family, my father is also from New Jersey and was the first generation of Swedish immigrants who came here to find the promised land. And we're successful people. Unfortunately, with that, without meaning to air dirty laundry, but the truth of it is, my childhood was very painful and lonely. I was the product of an alcoholic family and always understood why from the sense of how much trauma and struggle had occurred to no one's fault. But the outcome was no emotional training, and the only acceptable reaction by a man, my father, was anger. So alcohol was a natural progression, and as a result, I was a very typical codependent child in a traditional, if you will, kind of American dysfunctional alcoholic family.
How did that impact, if it did, your ability to have friends, to socialize, to create your own dreams separate and apart from your family?
Well, it's so funny and interesting that you ask about dreams, because the dreams were always there. As a result of my parents and how they handled things, I was a very social creature, a very creative, curious child. But as a result, I was a lot of work, and they didn't really want to do that work. So by the time I was 6, 7, 8 years old, I was isolated for the most part in my room, in my imaginary life. And I played teacher, and I did all kinds of fun things and with my stuffed animals. But I was in my own world by myself. And later, as I got older, my mother, in her wisdom, she was from the Midwest and an only child herself. So she had had to learn to entertain herself early, and said very clearly to me, I'm not going to entertain you, but I'll teach you to entertain yourself. So she taught me how to sew, how to knit, how to needlepoint, crochet, and I was a natural crafter. She was very talented, and I had the same gift. So I spent most of my preteen years, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, sewing in my room, making my clothes and wearing them to school the next day, even through high school. In fact, that skill set took me all the way through college, and I made all my formals and all my dresses. And it was a really gratifying, very satisfying, very pride-filling thing to have this skill and be able to channel my sadness into something so productive.
So clearly you had the experience of making something beautiful out of nothing.
Absolutely. We all have that, I believe. I believe that we all, if we look deep inside, and in today's world where we're doing so much for children all the time that they're not ever really drawing from their inner resources. And sadly, the struggle is where the lessons come. The pain is where the learning comes from. And none of us want to go through it, and no one wants to see someone suffer. But the truth is, it is a natural part of the human condition. And my experience of finding a very healthy distraction and a productive art, if you will, was absolutely the medicine I needed, and ultimately took me all the way through to today and a company that has been born of the exact same mindset post 9/11, which is a long way down the road, but I never knew what I was doing in sixth grade would play out in my life today.
So it really is interesting and extraordinary. And I guess if you think about it, so many of us, when we look at those those skills that we tend to enjoy as adults, very often they started at childhood. There was a little germ of something that was often kind of floating around in our early childhood, so we don't really think about it.
We don't think about it, and I think dreams, as your questioning started, those dreams get extinguished somewhere along the line because they're just not important enough, they're not sexy enough, they're not, the parents aren't into it, so the child, they dissuade or redirect, when in fact we are intuitive beings. And you know, as children before the age of six, before we're really, you know, introduced to culture and education and the box that we ultimately are all put in, we are these very enlightened, creative creatures, very much connected to Source, very much connected to God, without any editing. We are pure sponges and pure receivers of our world around us. And if we could just remember that as we get older, and I say that to people now, like, what did you used to love to do? What was your hobby? You know, and I worry for my own children because there's not a big hobby factor now because it's social media.
Right.
And I have a young adult, teenagers and young adults now. And it's not a healthy distraction at all, but it is a prevalent, obviously completely consuming times everyone in our culture now.
Well, you know, it's interesting how parents often unknowingly, unwittingly, and certainly not to create harm, but parents along with society have this ability to put people in boxes and not necessarily to keep the lid open. And so you, as you mature, you really do have to open up that lid yourself and look inside yourself. And some folks just aren't happy about that.
Well, you're not supported by it in society. So if we look at the fact that the paradigm we've been living in is a paradigm of rules and shoulds, and this is what I've studied. So this is my opinion, but this is my digestion down of 15 years of focus and hyper study on why. Why are we where are we here today? Why were we not emotionally prepared for 9/11? What went on, what's happening, and where are we going? So in that study, I realized that, and my experience of 9/11 was, all bets were off. 9/11, that morning, all the rules were broken. And I was shot out of that box that I never fit in the first place, only to find myself out of the box and exactly where I should have been the whole time. And what that means is, I was trusting myself. I trusted my intuition. I trusted my gut instinct. And I did what felt right because no one had the rules. No one had the answers anymore. Not my parents. There was no wizened elder saying, do this, do this, do this. I had myself to trust. And that to me, for all of us going forward, is we have to remember we have everything we need inside. We've just forgotten. We've been educated to look outside for our answers and outside for our happiness, when in fact it's all from within, and it all exists here every single day and always has.
It's so true. And, you know, children, I often say this, you know, when you're born, you don't know that you're supposed to be afraid or angry or sad. You don't know those things. So you are, as you said, you're naturally creative and expressive and a sponge, looking to draw in just what the world is around you. Tell us about the world around you when you met your husband, Tim. We're now out of your teenage years. How did Tim come into being?
It's actually Teddy. I do have a son named Tim.
I'm sorry.
It's a little confusing. I
okay.
get it. So I met Ted Luckett in New York City. I had lived in Denver, actually. I was in radio, and I spent 3 years there getting my feet wet and knowing how much I loved it. I wanted to work in the number one market in the country. So I moved myself back, and I was alone and struggling in New York for a year and a half. And at the end of a very difficult 18 months, I finally was popping through, and I was finally finding success at my job, having had my head handed to me in so many ways. Another story. But the prize at the end of that year was meeting Ted Luckett. And all of my life, because of my background and my upbringing within this alcoholic system, my self-esteem was toast. I had complete self-loathing, self-love wasn't even anything on my radar. I hated myself. I was suicidal for many years in the thought process. I don't know that I've ever really done it. And the reason I wouldn't have done it is I didn't want to hurt my mother. Meanwhile, that's really who should have been with me the whole time and wasn't. So, but she didn't know that. She was doing her best because she was following society's rules. So when I met Ted Luckett, my life began. I had worked myself through all of these difficulties. It's a long story, but I learned self-love in that 18 months in New York because I didn't give up. I worked 3 jobs because I couldn't afford to pay my parking garage bill, but I couldn't alternate side of the street park my car because that was impossible, you know, but I couldn't afford to buy milk. So I just kept working at new different jobs, but it didn't last forever. And the self-esteem that came from saving myself and getting myself through, because that little grain, what you're talking about in the dream, that little grain of I have it, I can do this, kept me going in these very dark moments, mind you, with no one around helping me. So meeting Ted Luckett was my prize, because here was this charming, funny, successful, handsome, with friends out the wazoo, and I think he was in 30 weddings. You know, there's just, he was so awesome, and I remember meeting him and saying, he is just way too cute. I just can't even, I would never ruin this amazing friendship by going out with him. He means too much to me.
Interesting.
So that's how it started, which was a really nice foundation.
So how did the two of you move from way too cute to marriage? That seems like there was a little bit of a road there.
Well, I was in love with him from the minute I met him, and he with me. Within 2 weeks, he told me he loved me, and we just had this amazing time. And the nice thing was, as alpha and female as I am and controlling and edgy, he was equally as laid back and easy. And as a result, he rounded off my edges. But I also motivated him to step his game up. So together as a team, we were far better together than we were apart. So it was a really nice partnership in that way.
That's what partnerships are supposed to be about.
Yeah.
Better together than alone.
Right. You know, and it's given me, it wasn't perfect. Actually having children is when things get really hard, because you don't know to, I didn't know to ask, so how are you in the kitchen? So are you going to get up and give them the feeding at 2 o'clock in the morning? Are you going to change a diaper? Will you help me? And the truth was, I love him to death, and with all due respect, he was really lazy, and he didn't want to do all those things, and he didn't care that the dishes weren't done. He could wait me out, and I was so compulsive, and then the added dimension of being a mother, and I was, by the time I had children, fully neurotic and crazy, having had this upbringing, this life, and then a sales job, which is founded in crazy, and then living in New York on top of it. So by the time I was in my early to mid-30s, I was pretty certifiable.
I was
so
about
I had
to say,
high expectations.
Sounds like you should have been if you weren't.
Yeah.
So you meet Ted, and at some point you're married, you have children. Talk about what life was like just prior to 9/11. Where were you living? How old were your children? What was going on? Where was Ted? Where was he working? What was going on?
Okay, so Teddy had worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. So Cantor Fitzgerald was at the top of the North Tower. That's the one that was hit first with the antenna. And Cantor Fitzgerald also lost by far the largest number of people. They lost 658 people that day. So, and that's another story in and to itself. But Teddy had worked there for 10 years.
Such an astounding number. 650.
It's a staggering number.
658 people.
But the truth is, Howard Lutnick, who went on television and had a very bad reputation as far as being just a cold, calculating guy, which, of course, if you're going to be successful on Wall Street, that's required. But I watched him grow, his heart grow 3 sizes that day, and he did everything for us that he promised, far and above what other companies did for their people. So it was a beautiful thing to watch, actually. I mean, my experience of 9/11 had so much beauty in it, which is ultimately why I'm talking to you today. Because I have a campaign myself, my little self-imposed campaign of let's see the silver linings that came from this experience. Let's try to learn from it. And really the root of the whole thing is my my need to make something good come from this nightmare that I vowed that morning that I would not let Teddy and all those people die in vain, that I was determined to make something good come from this. But to back up for the story, so Teddy worked for 10 years at Canner. I had my own relationship at the World Trade Centers because I worked for a radio station called CD101.9, which was the contemporary jazz station. So we had jazz concerts on Tobin Plaza, where the big globe was, every Wednesday for the 5 years that I worked there, and jazz cruises out of southern Manhattan around the Statue of Liberty. So the World Trade Centers, to me, were very, very important, and I had my own relationship with them. So Teddy was there. We lived in New York until my daughter, Jennifer, was 2.5, and then I was pregnant with my son, and we moved to where I grew up, which I never thought I'd move back to, but in the time since I had left there as a teenager to moving back, they started a ferry. So there was a really nice commuter ferry into southern Manhattan, and that's what opened up this little market in New Jersey, which was about an hour and a half train ride. So it was kind of far, but the boat was only 45 minutes, and it was a sweetheart of a commute. So that's how we ended up getting down here. And so I stopped my job. I worked in radio until literally the day before we moved. So when I got home, I had a 2.5-year-old that I basically didn't know because she'd been with a nanny the whole time.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was hard. It was really hard. And Teddy then started getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to take the 7 o'clock ferry and all the exhaustion that goes with commuting. So I was with kids, and I had been using my brain for 15 years. I was, you know, very much a career person, and to meet with that abrupt halt was excruciating. Being home with children is very tedious. Those are long days, and especially when you have a child who doesn't want to be there because you've just uprooted her out of her very comfy life with everything she knew. It was crazy.
It takes courage, though, as a parent to admit that there are times when spending the days home alone with children is challenging.
It is challenging, and I guess courage is the word. And I guess if there's one thing I have, it's a lot of courage. But that I didn't know that. But the truth is, it's just being honest. And it's hard. It's a very hard job to do something when you've gone from a thinking, logic-driven position to a completely nurturing, supportive place where you're really not getting a lot back for a long time from children. You know, that was my experience, is you're giving and giving and giving and giving. And it takes a long time. Even you might get the smile or the, you know, hug or the I love you. But it's a lot. It's a lot in those early years to keep going and not get depressed and not get frustrated.
Did you ever consider during that time, I mean, you grew up in an alcoholic household, where alcohol was used to manage all manner of thoughts and feelings. Did you ever think in those times in particular, feeling much more isolated than you had when you were going out to a job outside of the home every day, did you ever consider turning to alcohol?
Dr. Brew, it's a really important part of my story. So alcohol was the way I got through my miserable childhood in high school here in this area that we live in. It's a beach community. There's bars everywhere. The drinking age in New Jersey was then 18. So we were all drinking in bars as sophomores in high school with fake IDs. And it was the only way, having been so ill-fitting within society, that once I started drinking, I fit. Here was a common denominator. And I was really good at it. I didn't get sick. I could hold my liquor. I didn't slur my words. But I wasn't, you know, drinking out of a bottle in my bedroom at 10 o'clock in the morning. This was a social drinking. And when I met Ted and I were both great partiers. It was the 80s. Our sport was drinking. And we were great, and we had a great time. We would go out and entertain clients together from both of our jobs, and we were great at it. It was very successful. So then when I got home, I ended up having what I would call like a daily, I would drink a couple of glasses of wine at night. And Teddy was more of a weekend guy. He could have a soda during the day, but I wasn't a soda drinker, and I loved my wine. So I had a friend at the time. We all had little children together, and she was the same kind of drinker. And we would say to each other, do you think we're alcoholic? No, we're not alcoholic. No. Well, it got to a place, finally, when Teddy died, I was still having my glasses of wine at night because it was the only thing I didn't have to share with my children. The only adult action or activity I had.
So it was
and
yours.
And I needed that.
It was yours.
It was mine.
Lisa,
right, because that's true.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to pick up right here, because that's an interesting look at how one thinks about drinking. It was yours, and nobody could take it away from you. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Lisa Luckett, a post 9/11 widow, sadly to say. We will be right back. The thought that alcohol was, of course, it was something that you grew up with, but it was also something that was yours, and it was something that was very much connected to your strong, independent, successful adult life. So home with the children, from that perspective, it makes sense that you would reach back to something that was clearly yours, as you say, and you could own it. The children weren't going to take that away from you.
That's right. But so I would wake up in the morning, however. If you drink like that, even 2 to 3, it was about a half a bottle a night. And plenty of people drink this way and do fine, I guess, with it. But I would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning dehydrated. So I'd be wide awake from 3 to 5 and then fall back to sleep only to get up at 6 and then have to be up all day with children. And never be, you can't just lie down and need a nap. It doesn't work like that. You are really at the whim of their schedule. And so I didn't increase my drinking until a couple of years after Ted died. And part of my story, which is really important, and the reason I am here today the way I am, is the morning of 9/11 when I was shot out of that box and I knew... In fact, this was the equivalent of having every emotional bone in your body broken simultaneously. If it was your physical body, you'd go to the doctor. So I took myself to the doctor because no one knew what to do, and I was determined to figure it out. That being, I went to a psychoanalytic analyst for full psychotherapy. And I put my daughter Jennifer, who was then 7, my son Billy was 4, and my baby Timmy was 4 months, so Jennifer, because she was a very astute child, a very adult child, she was just one of those kids that just didn't need fuzzy, cute things. She was in the game with me. We both started in therapy within 6 weeks of 9/11. So Jennifer, as an aside, is an anomaly. She has had nothing but the straight story from 2 therapists, 2 women, and myself since she was 7.
Interesting.
It's really interesting. She's 22 today, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with her. But my point being that I go to therapy, and I was about a year and a half into therapy, and I learned that alcohol, any drugs you take, alters your brain chemistry, obviously. Well, when you're trying to do an analysis, you have to retrieve very old memory, very, very early memory. When you have that chemistry there, it can't do that. So my therapist would say to me, and I wanted mental health more than anything, having had such a crazy life, I saw the light at the end of the tunnel. I wanted it. And I would say to my therapist, like, how do I get there? How do I get there? She said, we can't finish your therapy until we get your father out of the room, and we can't get your father out of the room until you stop drinking.
How did you hear that? What did that mean when you heard that?
Well, I didn't stop right away, but I stopped about 3 months later after I pulled a behavior on my daughter that my father used to do to me. And I was so angry over the course of many events, not me just being angry, but a lot of catalyst, that I started yelling. And I couldn't stop yelling. I could not stop yelling. And the next morning, she was 10. The next morning, she got up and she was puffy-eyed. She hadn't slept all night. It was like I had beaten her. And I stopped.
It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking, but it was also saving.
Yes.
You know, like there's heartbreaking would have been if I hadn't stopped.
That's true.
And the truth is sometimes it takes these extremes to learn a lesson. And that's why I believe people shouldn't beat themselves up for their mistakes. That the mistakes are the catalyst to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and just do it differently. Like, you can do this anytime. And it's just, there's no judgment around this. There's no judgment on when your time is right. It will be right for you. And it was right for me. So a year and a half after I quit drinking, what happened? I popped through the ceiling to mental health. Because I'd had a year, it's literally like 14 months. It had cleared away the clutter. And what did I get? I got 2 years of processing. It's like someone took the top of my head off and 40 years of repressed thinking came shooting out of the top of it. Just like a cartoon. And I laughed that I was like Wile E. Coyote riding the Acme rocket. It was wild. And I reprocessed my life from about 12 to 24. And I started knitting for all my friends who had taken care of me. I felt so compelled to care for the women because I woke up and went, oh, who's taking care of women? Who's taking care of mothers? Who's taking care of caregivers? We're bleeding out literally all the time. Who's restoring us? And it was this completely intuitive, just I couldn't have gotten out of the way of this thing if I had wanted to. And I didn't want to. I wish everyone could have this experience. Times a million. So I start knitting, and while I'm knitting, what am I doing? I'm processing, because knitting, because it's tactile, it uses your fingertips, it uses touch. It calms your central nervous system. It also shifts you from your logical left brain over to your creative, intuitive right brain. So as you're knitting, you're able to literally let go, and what's fun is that the solutions that you've been trying so hard to get, they come. So it's very relaxing, it's very restorative, and so I started knitting. And at the same time, I started processing for this lifestyle philosophy about love and kindness, that all we really needed was to be nice to each other, that it was really just about warmth and comfort and care. Our human needs, our human creature comforts were not being met. Technology has really moved us off the mark.
That's true.
But we can correct that. So alcohol is the root. My just stopping drinking is the root of all of this enlightenment.
Well, let me ask you this. Post 9/11, I mean, you're right. In tons of ways, we as a country were not ready for 9/11. And then it happened. And then, of course, there was all kinds of feelings that came to the surface for all kinds of people in all kinds of ways. A lot of people were really angry. Were you angry? I mean, one day, one moment, you have your husband you love, you have your children, you have your home. Life is not without its challenges, but it's pretty good. And then all of a sudden, it's gone at the hands of you don't even know who. And at that point, you certainly didn't know why.
Well, I kind of did, because Teddy walked down in the first bombing in 1993. So it took him 4.5 hours to do the slow walk off the 105th floor of the North Tower. So I had dealt with terrorism then, and I was really angry. But that's another story, but it showed itself. I processed it and moved on, and they went back into that building with knowledge.
Well, let me interrupt you.
Everybody went back.
I want to interrupt you for a moment. Those listening who don't know what 1993 meant, what happened in 1993?
I'm sorry. Yes, I forgive me on that. So the first terrorist bombing for the World Trade Center was actually in late January of 1993, when a terrorist drove a van into the garage of the Vista Hotel, which was two buildings actually away from the North Tower. There was the South Tower and the Vista Hotel in between. So that explosion actually backfired and went down, not up. But this is what's interesting. Teddy worked up so far away from it, right? I could look down Manhattan from my windows on 42nd Street due south. There wasn't a wisp of smoke on that first explosion. Ted took 4.5 hours to walk down. When he met me at home that night at 5 o'clock, 5:30, when he got in the shower, the water ran black with the soot that was on him from being in those buildings. That's how much smoke had been contained within the two trade centers. So that when the morning of 9/11 happened, and I saw that black billowing smoke coming out of the top, I knew they were gone. So I was, in fact, prepared in a very strange way. I had been through terrorism before, and they went in with knowledge. That was a choice. It was a target already. We knew that. But because, again, we just kind of brushed it under the rug.
It happened. And it won't happen again. Life is
right.
Good.
Right. Like, because, you know, and this speaks to what I believe is why we were not emotionally prepared. And it's no one's fault, first of all. The first disclaimer is no one did this on purpose. But if you look at this country as being very young in the scheme of the globe, of the countries and the cultures we're dealing with, we're 250 to 500 years old, depending on how you choose to count it. As a result, that is kind of an adolescent age as compared to our global neighbors. Well, what happens to an adolescent when they get hurt or they get scared? They react. So we have a culture of very ingenious, incredibly innovative, brilliant people that we've put so much on the map in our young life, right? Just like a very bright teenager. And we're going forward. We're not looking left or right to see who we're hurting in the meantime, to see any of the tertiary damage. We're just going for it. We're only using the left side of our brain. We're using our logic, our analytics. We haven't had time, literally, by no one's fault. We haven't had time to tune in to the right side, which is where your sensory input is. It's where your intuition is and your sensitivity is. It's been kind of poo-pooed because it's kind of a girly thing in the world that we've come from, out of a male-based kind of thinking. So when the mind is that out of balance, of course you're going to be unprepared because we haven't been tested. It's the struggle and the test that builds wisdom. So we are a culture, really, of my opinion, of a lack of wizened elders, if you will, to say, shh, 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 it's going to be okay. All we have to do is this, this, and this, because we've been here before. And the truth is we can start saying that because now we have been tested. My position on this whole thing, and again, the reason we're having this conversation today, is because I want us to start learning from this.
What should we learn? What do we need to learn? These are horrific acts.
We need to open
acts.
That right side.
Okay.
We need to allow. So there's two in the world of energy, okay, in the world of enlightenment source, and the people that are listening that understand that, they know this, that there's masculine energy and there's feminine energy. The masculine, we all have both. It's not being a girl or a boy. We all have both. If you like structure and logic and you're kind of an alpha and you're a girl, those are kind of masculine traits. Being sensitive, creative, you know, kind of softer. Those are feminine traits, but we all have both. We all know of lots of people, right? So if we can open up that right side, if we can allow, being the operative word, allow that right side to be opened and turn down the volume on the thinking side, just give it a rest already. I mean, if you just look at the logic of when you have kids in our schools today getting 4.0s, and 1600s on their SATs on a regular basis. We can't even get into college. I mean, these kids are so bright academically that there's nowhere else to go. Or you can spin it to this. You can say, when professional sports require steroids or some kind of synthetic enhancing drug to make you perform, that you just to be in the game, have we not maxed that out? So there's this whole frontier over here on the right side that we haven't even looked at yet. And it's this intuitive side. So if you go from this thinking, the mind is actually limited. The heart, which is the root of the right side, the root of our creativity, it's from your heart, is unlimited. So as human creatures, our humanness is our best feature. And in the last 2,000 years, we've been in a very masculine-based paradigm. We're actually moving energetically into a feminine-based paradigm, and that's explained by the astrologers, can't say it. We're moving out of the Aquarian age, Piscean age, excuse me, into the Aquarian age, and they're different energetic systems. Now, this is going out there a little bit, so you have to be open-minded, and that is really the crux of all of this. We have to be open-minded. 9/11 blew the doors open for me. All bets were off. It was a very dramatic example of rendering me extremely open. And when I was open, what happened? I got completely filled from source. This isn't mine. I'm just carrying it forward and sharing what I was given. There's many, many, many thousands of people in the same boat as me. And if you look into the recent writings that have come up, the books, the topics, this movement that has been coming for the last 10 or 15 years, but it's a very subtle movement. It's very quiet because it's very feminine, and it's in the form of language. I started doing yoga when I stopped drinking in 2003. No one was doing yoga. It was weird. Now it's being taught in gym class.
It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary, yeah. And it's a very short window of time because there's so much logic in it. Because at 9/11 happened, and people tried to pray it away, but it didn't really work. Traditional religion, I think, fell short, and all the other things that have been happening in our world as far as leadership goes, and there's been a lot of disheartening breaking down of what we thought was true in our structure. So it's with all of that, if people can see that this is an opening, we're breaking down the old ways so that new ways can come forward. You can apply it to the presidential race. We've got a very, very delineated position of the old way and the new way. Irregardless of my position on this, I'm not making a political statement.
Exactly.
But it's very clear if you choose to study it that way. So the right side, so we are very intuitive creatures. That is really what we are, which means you have to trust your sixth sense, your gut instinct. When your stomach hurts in a conversation, that's telling you to get away from that person, or that information is wrong, or that is a toxic place. But we never pay attention to it in the old paradigm. And I can tell you, my stomach hurt a lot in my life.
I would think I would think it hurt a lot while you were working in sales.
Oh, well, except sales is fun. sales is a challenge. Sales is a game. The whole thing is a game. I mean, life is a game. And, you know, to lighten up a little bit around it and decide that maybe I'm going to try something different. That today I'm going to put kindness first. And that's where I kind of have gotten to with where we are in our world today is, you know, we're all addicted to the media. We're addicted to the negativity. We're addicted to the drama. And, boy, it comes out every single day with all the shootings and everything, which that's a whole nother conversation. But how do we make kindness sexy? How do we sell kindness? Because it's going to change the world. Love will change the world. And it's a matter of, and this is one of my favorite explanations of kind of where we've gone and were and where we're going. If you look again at that masculine paradigm, that's a paradigm of power over, meaning you have to win. You have to power over, dominate, win, conquer. And it got us where we are. It took us through the last 2,000 years, and look at the last 100 years where humanity has come to. It's remarkable. But we're kind of stuck, right? We need something new to kick us to that next level. Feminine power is considered personal power, meaning I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and you're going to do what you're going to do. And we may not disagree, but I respect you enough that I'm going to still stay connected to you and be friends with you and go forward in our own passions, in our own purpose, and do what it is I'm here to do, be the piece of the puzzle I am meant to be. And we're all going to connect together in that puzzle for that harmony.
And so in so many ways, that is actually the more powerful stance to take and to live. Lisa, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to pick up with yet another challenge that you went through, as if 9/11 was not more than enough. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Lisa Luckett, who was described as a social visionary, an activist for kindness, and an advocate of gaining wisdom by experiencing life head on. We'll be right back. As people are listening to our conversation, listening to the story of your life, I know that there are some folks saying, okay, alcoholic household, 1993, 9/11, her husband dies. She has been through so much, I don't know how she did it, but at least it's done. What more could there be in her life? And yet, cancer came into your life.
Yep. Yeah, it did. It did. But I look at cancer, again, I tend to be a little cavalier, so please forgive me. I don't mean to ever appear insensitive. But if you come from the place of, if you knew me, you would know that I'm a warrior, and I rise to a challenge, as I said about being in sales. It's a game. Like, let's go. Let's try this. Show me something oppositional, and I'm going to try to figure it out. So it was the beginning of 2009. We had all watched Wall Street fall apart 3 and 4 months before in 2008, and which was horrible as well. And we were in a very dark place. And I went for my annual mammogram and ultrasound because I have dense breast tissue, and I went to a very progressive radiologist, and she would do ultrasounds for people. So on my routine, they found what looked like 2 stacked cysts. And this woman, who I loved to death, came in and said, don't really like how this looks. And at that point, I knew I had it. So 3 days later, the pathology came back. Yes, in fact, I had breast cancer. Well, after the initial shock of that, which is a shock, the word cancer in itself is a shock. And one of the things I would love more than anything is for us to be like the Eskimos, who have 125 words for snow. We need more words for cancer. Because the cancer I had was completely curable. I had lobular cancer. It's a jelly substance. It's not really a mass per se. It looks like a bunch of concentrated blood vessels. It's a rarer one, maybe 9% of the diagnoses. And I was able to have it taken out with about an egg-sized level amount of tissue, a lumpectomy. So when you look at me, I'm not even divoted. It was underneath my left side. So I looked the same. Looking in the mirror, I didn't have to suffer the horrible disfiguring that goes with a mastectomy. So that's a different experience. On top of that, I had 4 rounds of chemo because at the time I was 48 years old. I still had very young children. The risk of reinfection, I don't even know, was 10 or 20%. But my doctor said to me, why would you risk 1%? I said, you're right. So I had chemo. So what was the worst part of chemo? Losing my hair. Because the world doesn't know what to do with you. Because you look sick. You don't necessarily feel sick.
Right.
Of the 3-week cycle I had, days 3 through 9, I felt low. I felt toxic. I just felt like I wanted to lie down, but I was already lying down. I wanted to cry. But then it would pass, and I would be fine, although I looked weird. So I wore hats with hair and bands around my ears to like, so it looked like there was some fringe. And honestly, from 6 feet away, nobody noticed. But it made them more comfortable. My kids were so amazing. They would say, Mom, why are you even wearing that? You look great. So I was very lucky to have amazing children.
Absolutely.
That weren't embarrassed by me. And I know that's not always the case. But I was very proud of them for that. So after my chemo, I had 4 rounds of chemo. And then the last was, so that was about 12 weeks. And I had 33 rounds of radiation. Well, for me, radiation was just an appointment. It was 15 minutes. And after chemo, it was really nothing. So it was about a 10-month window of time. When I started, I had a very progressive oncologist who said to me, A, stay skinny, because tumors live on sugar. The next question she asked me was, do you drink? And I got to say no. How awesome. I can't imagine trying to kick a wine habit with a cancer diagnosis. So that was just a check off the box. And the last thing she told me is, for prevention, at the time when I went in, the protocol was 5 days of cardio, 30 minutes each, 30 minutes of cardio, 5 days a week. 10 months later when I left, prevention was 60 minutes of cardio, 6 days a week. And I have done that since. So 7 years I have been religious, and I just plugged it into my life like a job. It took me getting cancer so that I would exercise every day. But you can't dispute it at that point. So cancer for me was a test. Can I, in fact, learn a skill set for trauma management? What have I learned in my studies of the last 8 years? And the answer is, yeah, you really can learn a skill set. Not only that, it gets easier, if you will, because you understand what's coming. You know to just let it wash over you, to not try to control the fear, not try to control the anger or whatever emotion you're having, the grief, because all stages of grief are kind of in everything, and to just let it wash over you without controlling, because nature is remarkable and will give you the break you need. Nature or God or source, however you want to quantify that. But it's not this endless, like Teddy's death I thought would be this tidal wave of agony. This, and the, my water metaphors, please go with me, but tidal wave of agony. Endless agony, 24/7. It wasn't that at all. I was a nursing mother of a 4-month-old. Nature's not going to let you go down because I didn't try to control it. His mom had told me, because she was very worried about him, that she was really worried he was going to have a heart attack. So what happened to me? I ran his death through my mind hundreds of times.
Interesting.
And the truth is, your mind is so powerful, you can get yourself just as torqued thinking about the event as the event itself. However, here's the catch. Happened with 9/11, happened with breast cancer, happens with every single small to large traumatic event in anyone's life. And it's what I call the godness of 9/11. But it's really the godness of any experience. And it's the amazing human support, this love, this support, this generosity, kindness that comes in and flanks the situation. That while you're sitting in your bed at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about the worst thing that can happen to you and scaring the heck out of yourself, you're not imagining that there's going to be people there to catch you.
That's true.
And that's what I learned. And the godness of a situation is always there. Godness meaning goodness, the goodness of 9/11 without one of the O's.
Right.
And that name popped into my head years and years and years ago. And that's how it felt, because it kept me buoyant. So that holding, all those prayers that everyone listening sent to me, because I still get them to this day. Because people give me that extra moment of consideration because they know my story. But the truth is, so many people have even bigger stories than mine, and they carry them with incredible grace. But I get that consideration, which means I get the best of everybody all the time.
All the time.
It's an amazing thing to witness.
Tell us about Cosmina.
So Cosmina is this made-up name, meaning where coziness meets glamour, and it's what I named the shawls that I was making for my friends when I started knitting, back to the other part of the story. It then became the name of my company, which is Cosmina Enlightened Living. Because Cosmina, I thought, okay, this is going to be like Xerox or Kleenex. It's a made-up word meaning tissue or computers. Now this is going to mean kindness. So Cosmina's really, its core definition would be love and kindness. Cosmina Enlightened Living was my way, and all the products and the derivative products within that, the baked goods, the recipes, the knitting. There's a cancer care listing that has a vetted list of 40 internet resources for anyone dealing with a cancer diagnosis. All products that came through me in many ways that I really feel so passionately about giving to others, because Cosmina is my way of sharing forward or paying back all the kindness and love that was given to my children and I in the wake of 9/11.
Tell us about the knitting. You talked earlier about the sort of the peacefulness and the lightness, if you will, of just that tactile experience. Is that something that you think everyone should engage in, or should they choose their own resource or outlet?
Well, I'm, of course, very biased, because my answer to anyone when they tell me of a struggle they're having, my first answer is, you should knit, because knitting has worked so well for me. Knitting, though, is, again, back to tactile. It can be the same as strumming a guitar or patting a dog or painting a painting or writing music. Or it's whatever your creative outlet is what I believe people should do, is they should go to something, because what happens is when you're in that, you get into flow. You get into that place where it could be doing math for people that are math people. It's whatever allows your mind to disconnect. And when you're disconnected from what you're going through, you're giving yourself a break. And it's in that break that you can begin to heal. You've taken the pressure off. So knitting for me was not only taking care of all the people that had cared for me, that I saw needed care, but no, you know, so that was a very esoteric, enlightened thing. But it was satisfying me so well and making me feel so good. So I have taught about 175 women to knit on my couch in my family room for the last 3 years. I wanted to see if it would work for other people. And what in turn, what I actually say is, I'm going to teach you a form of meditation. Because knitting what we knit, which is very thick needles, very thick yarn, you don't need to count anything or measure anything. So you're not thinking at all. You're literally meditating. And the coolest part about knitting a Cosmina shawl for someone is with each stitch, and it's great for your mom or your sisters or any of your friends, but it really, the juice really comes when you're knitting for someone who's hurting, who's taking care of an aging parent, a caregiver, who's dealing with a sick child, who's just lost someone. You are infusing with every stitch, you are infusing your love and your care and your positive energy into that stitch, and it's literally carried within the garment, so that when you wrap it around her in the Cosmina fashion, which is to basically wrap it, you'll see it on the website, it wraps around and you feel like you're being held in a hug. It's literally like a mother's loving hug every time you wear it. So for people who have someone, know someone who's suffering, there's really nothing you can do. You can go to some doctor's appointments, you can make some food, and that's all great. You can be there on the phone. But here is something you can do that's going to help you soothe through the process, because you feel so sad about it. And you're able to give it to them and care for them in this way that is literally unmatched by anything that I've ever discovered. So I was able to translate that now to all of these other women as an experiment to see, could they learn it? Would they understand it? Would it work? And the answer is, it totally works for everybody.
Totally works. Tell us the website for Cosmina.
Well, it works for those who stay with it. You have to learn. It's a learning curve. You know, if you're 50 years old and you've never held a set of needles, it's going to be a struggle. But what have I been saying the whole time? The gift is in the struggle. you're going to feel so proud of yourself when you accomplish this, and you will accomplish it with enough tenacity to not give up. And we're so quick to give up when we don't do everything perfectly the first time, yet we tell our children, go to school.
Right.
Right? So it's very humbling. It's all good. There's so many good pieces of learning to knit. Or it can be, again, it can be another craft. It can be woodworking. It can be, I just believe so wholeheartedly in making something, showing something for your effort is so satisfying. And it fills you in such a way, it restores you, because you can only have so many facials, eat well so long and so often, and have so much exercise. There's another piece that was missing, and that was that inner restoration that comes from any kind of meditation. In this case, it's safe because the world doesn't know you're meditating. You don't even know you're meditating.
That's true. Let us have the website for Kozmina.
So it's a made-up spelling. It's spelled Kozmeena. And it's where it came up because the third friend I knit for, I wrapped it around her one cold morning with her kids in their jammies on a Sunday. And she said, oh, my gosh, this is the coziest thing I've ever worn. It's like a great big hug. And then she spun around and caught herself in the mirror and said, oh, but it's so glamorous. It's like a pashmina. No, it's a Kozmina. But I didn't know how to spell pashmina. So that's why it's Kozmeena.com.
All right.
And then it's all right there.
Kozmeena.
Yes.
All
or
right.
Lisa Luckett. They can get it'll funnel through Google lots of ways. So
okay. Lisa, I have to thank you so much for spending this hour and sharing your spirit and your energy with the listeners. And I understand that you're working on a book, so I thoroughly expect you to come back and talk to us about your book when it comes out.
Thank you so much. I would be, as I say, it's been an honor and a pleasure to talk to you, Dr. Brewer. You're the best.
Well, thank you. And if you had one thing you wanted to say to people as we close out the conversation, what would you say?
I would say to remember that you have courage, that you're stronger than you think you are. And that courage is defined as having fear of something, but doing it anyway. Because on the other side is this amazing gift, is this amazing lesson, and it's always there.
It's always there.
It's always there.
Again, Lisa Luckett, thank you so much. A mom, an entrepreneur, a kindness advocate. Thank you so much. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communication, and it is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you're encouraged to send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's myndtalk.org. Folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable.